Fato Banda.
Okay, we start with the three vows to the Buddha. Salutation to the Buddha. And today is June 26th. Okay. June 26th, 2010. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so we've been studying the greater discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. This is sutta number 28 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Is my voice carrying to the back all right? Okay, and in this discourse, Venerable Sariputta is explaining the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. Yeah, the mute is on. Okay, how about, Okay, so Venerable Sariputta has been explaining the Four Noble Truths that have been taught by the Buddha, and he does so first by enumerating each of the four truths. Then he takes the first noble truth, the noble truth of dukkha, or suffering, and then he analyzes or explains the different aspects of dukkha, birth, old age, sickness, death, and so on, till he comes to the five aggregates. The five aggregates are the factors of our individual identity, and the Buddha says that these five aggregates are the essential meaning of the first noble truth. Okay, so then Sariputta enumerates the five aggregates, the aggregate of bodily form or material form, the aggregate of feeling, the aggregate of perception, the aggregate of formations or volitional activities, and the aggregate of consciousness. Then out of the five aggregates, he takes the one aggregate, which is the aggregate of material form, and then he divides this into the two aspects. There's the aspect of primary matter, which is the four great elements, and then there's the secondary matter, or derived the matter that is derived from the four great elements. And then he takes the earth element and he analyzes the earth element, and then he uses the earth element as a basis for showing basic truths of Buddhism: impermanence, non-self, dependent origination, and so on. Okay, so I just want to map this out on the board. Okay, so we can sort of map out the sequence of the discourse. I think the camera, it's best after it gets the board to turn it away, otherwise it gets the reflection. Okay, so the section which is given the most attention is the section on the internal elements. And so we started with the earth element, and now we come to the water element. And if you remember last time, I explained that each element, we actually have two ways to look at the element. One is in terms of the growth or evident manifestation of the element. So the earth element is whatever is hard and solid in the body, like skin, flesh, bones. We'll come to the water element. And the other way to look at the element is in terms of its characteristic. And so the earth element actually represents the property of hardness, solidity, and it actually goes along a scale from hardness to softness. So those are the two extremes of the earth element. And every degree of hardness or degree of softness is some kind of manifestation of the earth element. The water element, on the one hand, it's manifest most obviously in the liquid parts of the body: blood, sweat, phlegm and so on. But the liquid element also represents the, or the water element represents the property of being a liquid, or sometimes it's called the property of flowing. So whatever is flowing in the body is a manifestation of the water element. And then in the Abhidhamma, the water element is also said to have the property of cohesion. What binds the particles of earth element together is said to be the water element. I'm not sure that I can agree with this, actually, from a scientific point of view. Since if you take water, okay, and you freeze it, it turns to ice. But why does it turn to ice? Because the molecules of the water cohere in a way that they don't when the water is in the liquid state, right? Anybody with a background in physics, simple physics? You do.
Well, no, but if you put two drops of water together, they sort of, they'll come together.
Well, that's a good observation. Maybe it's the fact that streams of water will flow together, whereas if I put this rod together with the chime, I have to melt them in order to get them to flow together. Okay, so then the fire element is the, on the one hand, it's manifest in things like fire or the bodily heat. And then we see it in any kind of degree of heat in any substance. And then the air element, we can see it most obviously in bodily processes like breathing in and breathing out. But at the abstract level, the air element has the property of, sometimes it's said, distension, that's swelling up. And sometimes it's said to be expansion and contraction. Since when we breathe in, then the lungs expand. When we breathe out, the lungs contract. Okay, so now we'll come back to the text. We're on page 280. And we'll take paragraph 11. So Sariputta says, what, friends, is the water element? The water element may be internal or external. Then what is the internal water element? Okay, whatever there is internally belonging to oneself, part of one's own body, that is water or watery, or liquid and liquidish, and that is clung to. In other words, this really means what is organic. And then he takes some examples, that is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, urine. Okay, so those are 12 liquids or fluids within the body. And then he says, whatever else there is, internally belonging to oneself, that is water, watery, and organic. So this is called the internal water element. Okay, now, again, we take this internal water element, and then we take the external water element. Water coming out from the tap, rainwater, water in streams and lakes and ponds, water from the shower or the bath. Okay, when we examine the external water element and the water element of the body, we see that they're both the same in that they are both manifestations of the water element. They both have the same property of fluidity, of flowing, of cohesion. And so we have, it's pretty hot, water element, which has been infused with a strong admixture of the fire element, because it's rather hot. Okay, but the cup now, this is, contains external water element, then I drink it, and before long it becomes internal water element. So I identify, that's mine. It's now part of my body. Then after an hour or two, then I have to go to the bathroom to make urine, and the water element comes out, and then what was mine now becomes external water element. And so we have this constant exchange of external water element, internal water element, internal water element becomes external water element. And so when we look at them in terms of the property of simply being the water element, we break down this distinction or discrimination between the internal and the external. What's mine and what is just out there. And so then when we focus on the water element, whether it be external or internal, the Buddhist Sariputta says, that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So even this body, which consists of the water element, we can see that it's not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, when one sees this as it actually is with proper wisdom, then one becomes disenchanted with the water element. That is, one is no longer, you know, fascinated or enthralled by the body, taking this body with the water element to be I and mine. And then the mind becomes dispassionate or detached from the water element. Okay, now Sariputta is going to approach the impermanence of the water element from a particular angle. Now he's going to take the, call this the cosmic dimension of the water element. So he says, this is paragraph 12, now there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed, it gets agitated. In other words, they're supposed to come terrible floods in the future. Hurricanes, cyclones, downpours, heavy storms. This is supposed to be at the end of this particular world cycle. So then the water element comes pouring down. It carries away villages, towns, cities, districts, and even whole countries. And so there comes a time when the waters that's how water element becomes excessive, but now we're going to see how the water element starts to disappear. Okay, there comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sink down 100 leagues, 200 leagues, 300 leagues, 400 leagues, 500 leagues, 600, 700 leagues. So the water is getting lower and lower. Then there comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand only 7 palm trees deep. 6 palm trees, 2 palm trees, down to only 1 palm tree. How tall is a palm tree? About 12 feet, 15 feet, 15 feet high of water. Okay, then there comes a time when the water in the great ocean stands 7 fathoms deep, 6 fathoms, 2 fathoms, only 1 fathom deep, it's only 6 feet deep. Then there comes a time when the water in the great ocean stands 0.5 fathom, only up to the waist, only up to the knee, even only up to the ankles. And then there comes a time when the water in the great ocean completely disappears, so there's just a little moisture in what used to be the ocean. I think this will be the time in the future when the sun starts to expand and its heat increases, so it starts drying, evaporating all of the water on the earth. I mean, this will happen in the future. You don't have to start filling buckets with water tonight, since it might be millions and millions of years in the future. But do leave a message for your great, 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 great grandchildren. Telling them to remember to fill the buckets before the sun expands. Okay, so now all of the water has disappeared except a little moisture in the ground. And so Sariputta says, when even this external water element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what can be said of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts just a short while, 70, 60, 70, 80 years, and it's gone. And so there can be no considering this body and this internal water element of the body, no considering it as I, mine, or I am. Okay, so in this way, Sariputta sort of dramatically highlights the impermanence of the body. And then shows the body to be not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, so then let's just go through this other section quickly that's been deleted. We just go back to paragraph 8, just to go through it quickly. Okay, so then if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass one who has seen this element as it actually is, then he understands that this is a painful feeling which is born of ear contact. Because others are abusing you, so what's arisen is just a painful feeling of displeasure because of the abuse. So one considers that sound is dependent. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. Contact through the ear. One sees the contact as impermanent, feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness, they're all impermanent. And so, after having meditated on the element, one now switches over into this new situation and investigates it in terms of conditionality, dependent arising. And then from dependent arising, one comes into the impermanence of all these factors. Okay, so then if others start beating you with sticks, knives, and so on, then one reflects this body is of this, such a nature to be beaten, hit, and wounded. And then one remembers the simile of the saw, where the Buddha says that you should not arouse hatred even towards those who cut your body into pieces. Okay, and then if in this way one is trying to develop equanimity, patience and equanimity towards those who are afflicting you. Okay, then if you still can't develop that equanimity, then you have to recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and stir up a sense of urgency to establish a sense of equanimity, an attitude of equanimity towards those who afflict one. Okay, and then if one establishes that equanimity, that wholesome equanimity, then one can be satisfied, and Sariputta says, at that time, much has been done by that monk. Okay, let's go through the other two elements now, remaining two elements. Okay, then we come to the fire element, which has the property of heat. Okay, so now Sariputta says the fire element also might be internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever there is internally belonging to oneself that's fiery and clung to. So this is whatever there is in the body that is hot. So he says that is that by which one is warmed. You know, this is the natural heat of the body, 98.6 usually. Whatever ages, it's said that it's through the fire element that the body matures and grows old. And by which one ages, and by which the body is consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted is completely digested. Since digestion is really the process by which the body warms up the food that one eats in the stomach and then dissolves it into the hydrochloric acid, which is able to function through the heat element, and then it absorbs the food into the body. And then whatever else there is in this body that's hot, fiery, and so on, this is called the internal fire element. Okay, now one contemplates the inner fire element and the external fire element. For example, the heat of the sun, the heat of a fire, the heat of coming from a radiator in the winter. Okay, so they're all simply, when you look at them objectively, different manifestations of the same element, the fire element. So I can't take the fire element in the body to be mine. Don't take the external fire element to be something separate from myself. But in fact, this body has come into being through the heat of the sun, through the energy of the sun. The energy of the sun gets converted by the plants into energy, which is stored up in plants in the form of sugars and starches. Then when I eat food, it breaks down those sugars and starches into the constituents and then reassembles them in the body into the organic matter of the body. And so it's the heat of the sun in the form of the energy stored in food which gets released into the body and provides the building blocks for my own body and also the energy of my own body. And then our bodies are constantly giving out heat which will be absorbed into the atmosphere. So if you ever go into a crowded elevator, even if it's a winter day where it's quite cold outside, but people are packed into the elevator, you notice the elevator is getting warm. Why is that? The air might be outside 65 degrees, but our bodies are always emitting heat at the temperature of 98.6. And so in the crowded elevator, it could be almost like the weather today. Okay, so the inner fire element, the external fire element, simply fire element, and then one contemplates this as it really is. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Okay, the rest the same, up to paragraph 17 now. Now we're going to see how even the fire element becomes impermanent. Okay, there comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed. This could be the outbreak of a great conflagration, a great fire which burns up everything. So it burns up villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. And then when it burns up all of the fuel, then that fire goes out. And then there comes a time when they seek to make a fire, even with a cock's feather or hide paring. And so it becomes very difficult to make a fire, supposedly, at this time in the future. Okay, so when even this external fire element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what if of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a short while? And maybe a better example for the fire element, the way it goes out cosmically, there'll come a time, this happens to just about all the stars, when they consume all of their fuel, and then what happens is that they collapse in upon themselves, then they explode in a massive explosion, and then what's left is just certain of the elements fuse, and it just becomes cold stone floating through space. And so this great sun, which has been heating up this planet for 13 billion years, something like that, 7 billion years, I don't remember. Does anybody remember exactly?
Look it up.
No, don't bother. Okay, billions of years, it goes out and becomes stone cold. We don't have to worry about trying to light a fire at that time, since there won't be any human life left on the earth. There won't be any earth left. Okay, then we come to the air element. Again, air element is internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belongs to oneself, that's air, airy, and clung to. In other words, any of the gases in the body. So we have upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, that's in the stomach, winds in the intestines, winds that move through the limbs. If that seems a little strange, I think the ancient Indians analyzed like what we would call nerve impulses in terms of winds going through the limbs. So when I stretch out my arm, I'm able to do this because the mind sets in motion a process which stirs a particular type of wind element which causes the arm to bend out, to stretch out. When I bend in my arm, that's because the mind initiates another activity of a wind element which causes the arm to bend in. So the winds that move through the limbs, then the most obvious instance of the air element is in-breathing and out-breathing. Okay, so whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and organic. This is called the internal air element. Okay, now we have the internal air element and then the external air element. And they're both simply the air element. And so when I breathe in, I take the external air element into my lungs. From the lungs, the oxygen goes into the bloodstream, it gets circulated to the cells, and that cells bind the oxygen and use it for their metabolism. And so the air externally becomes internal. And then at the same time that the blood is going through the bloodstream, it picks up the carbon dioxide and waste gases being discharged. And then those come out when I breathe out and become part of the external air element. So in this way, we break down this distinction between the internal and the external. Okay, when one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, then one becomes disenchanted with the air element and makes the mind dispassionate with the air element. Okay, then to show the cosmic impermanence of the air element, there comes a time when the external air element is disturbed, then strong winds blow, sweeping away villages, towns, cities, and so on. But there comes a time in the last month of the hot season when people use a fan or bellows or even pieces of straw in order to make wind. Okay, so in this way, the external air element is seen to be impermanent, subject to seas. And so what of this air element in the body? That too is impermanent, so it can't be considered as I or mine. Okay, so this takes us through the opening section on the four great elements. If there are any questions, then please feel free to ask them now. Okay, is there a similar analysis of the other four khandhas of the Pali Canon? Well, there's analysis of the khandhas into their constituents, not exactly in the same way, but Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 22, the chapter on the five khandhas, if you look through that, you'll find a few suttas which analyze the khandhas into their constituents. Do the Nikayas take this analysis of elements to the level of kalapas? No, the kalapa is a term that's used in the Abhidhamma commentaries. I won't go into the explanation of it. Any questions? Okay, please.
I have a question about the. It sounds like what's being said here is that the elements are really part of our relative reality, and that if we were in absolute reality and could perceive that, the qualities of these elements would not be apparent. Or are the qualities of the elements just sort of inherent in matter?
I think it's the second alternative. That it's not that the elements are just part of apparent reality which disappear in ultimate reality. In fact, this distinction of apparent reality and ultimate reality, we don't actually find that in the Nikayas, but it comes in later phases of Buddhism. So the elements are actually, you know, from the standpoint of contemplation, the elements are actually there, but what is somewhat an artificial distinction is the distinction between the internal element and the external element. So that is just a relative distinction, because the things that are now external become, over time, they become, certain of them become internal, and those things which are internal to the body become external. And then eventually when this body dies, say it's buried, then it decays, and so all of the matter of the body just becomes part of the earth. It gets eaten by different creatures. If we put the whole body into the coffin, eventually creatures will, even though now they're trying to make the coffins really tight so no creatures can get in. You know, it's how that sense of I and mine attaches. You know, they take the dead body, you have to make it look beautiful, youthful. Then you put it in an absolutely airtight, enclosed coffin. So I don't want any critters getting into my coffin. I don't want them eating up my body. But, you know, in the good old days, they just, you know, either a simple wooden coffin or cremate the body, and everything in the body just goes into out into the world. It's better to get it cremated than it just goes quickly, but you put it in a coffin in the ground, and then creatures come, worms, beetles, other creatures, and they start nibbling away, they have a nice feast on the body, then they go back to their, back into the soil, then they excrete the residue of their meal into the ground, and then it becomes soil. And I should say that even though this is set out in a very like analytical way like this, but these statements shouldn't just be seen as material to read, but this is actually a kind of theme for meditation. So that when one does the meditation on the elements, then after one gets a good sort of sense of the internal elements, then one does this reflection, very close reflection, on the essential identity between the elements of one's body and the external elements. And then it really helps to break down that sense of identification with the body. Okay, so now in terms of our scheme, Sariputta has taken the four elements, dealing with them, especially in terms of the internal, but also bringing in the external. But so far he's been analyzing primary matter. Now, step by step, he's going to bring in everything from the Four Noble Truths that he has put aside. So we come to paragraph 26. And he says, friends, just as when a space is enclosed by timber and creepers, grass and clay, it comes to be termed a house. Okay, so we have this building, we have these beams, these planks of wood, we have the walls, floor, everything set up, and so we have the idea this is Guanyin Hall. But if we look at it analytically, what is Guanyin Hall? Take away the walls, knock down the walls. Is Guanyin Hall still there? Yeah, it's still there. Take away the beams from the roof. Or the boards from the roof. Guanyin Hall is still there. Maybe now you're a little more doubtful, but you say, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, it's still there. Then you knock down the walls, so just the floor remains. Kuan Yin Hall's still there. Well, now you're about three quarters doubtful, but you say, maybe. But now we pull up the planks of the floor, and so there's nothing left but the space where Kuan Yin Hall stood. And you say, is Kuan Yin Hall there? Not anymore.
if everybody here recognized that this used to be Kuan Yin Hall, so Kuan Yin Hall, and it is, and if we all died and nobody remembers this place, then it ceased to be Kuan Yin Hall.
No.
It's all about designation.
We would all say, ah, Kuan Yin Hall used to be there.
But if we so congregate, empty space.
Well, we could congregate, but we would say that we congregate in the place that used to be Kuan Yin Hall. Or if you say that's Kuan Yin Hall, it's done with a kind of note of irony. That's Kuan Yin Hall? Okay, so what we call this body, what we call the house depends on these timber, creepers, grass, and clay. And so we have a space that's enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin. It comes to be termed, here we call it rupa, but it really means rupa in the sense of the body. According to the commentarial way of explanation, it's the space that's enclosed by the skin, by the bones and sinews, that represents the derived matter. That's the commentarial way of explanation, but I think my suspicion is that it's actually the body which is the derived matter. Because the body, as, you know, the way we conceive it as being a single entity, is something that depends upon these substances composed of the four great elements. And so we get this conception of the body as being some kind of solid, unified, whole, an entity existing in itself. But when you look what really is there, then one can start breaking it down into skin, sinews, flesh, bones, blood, sweat, fat, and so on. And those parts are also composed of the four great elements. And so we have these four elements cohering into organs and tissues and fluids. The organs, tissues, and fluids cohere together to form what we call the body. And so I think it's actually the form of the body that's derived matter. Okay, so now we have primary and derived matter, at least part derived matter. Now Sariputta is going to bring in all of the other aggregates with a very interesting section that starts on paragraph 27. This is a kind of Buddhist analysis of perception, the way perception occurs. Okay, if, friends, internally the eye is intact, in other words, the eye is functioning in a healthy way, but no external form comes into its range, and there is no corresponding engagement or attention, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. Okay, so let's say, okay, normally we're seeing things because the eye is a primary organ of sense of perception. So when we're awake, we're always seeing things. But let's just take in terms of a specific entity. Let's say birds. Okay, internally my eye is intact, but no birds come into range. When I'm in the Kuan Yin Hall, I don't see any birds. Okay, and there is no corresponding engagement or attention to birds. And so there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. In other words, there's no eye consciousness, visual consciousness, seeing birds. Okay, now we come to the next one. If internally the eye is intact and external forms come into its range, but there is no corresponding engagement or no attention, and still there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. Okay, so again, we'll take that same example. Okay, my eye is functioning normally, and maybe I'm giving the explanation of the sutta. Maybe some bird, well, I just saw one right outside. Okay, I'm giving an explanation of the sutta, and then a bird comes into the hole, or actually there are probably birds flying around these trees outside all the time, coming into range of my eye, but because I'm looking at the audience and thinking about what I'm saying, so I don't see the bird. And the reason I don't see it is because my attention doesn't go to the bird. Okay, now that I mentioned birds, I'm just looking all the time out the window to see birds are flying. Okay, but when internally the eye is intact and external forms come into range and there is the corresponding conscious engagement, or there is that attention, it's drawn to the object, then there is the manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. Then there is eye consciousness or visual consciousness, in this case, seeing birds. Okay, so when the text speaks of the corresponding section of consciousness, what we actually have occurring here is a kind of whole experience, a complete experience, in which consciousness is the chief factor. Because consciousness is what knows the object. Okay, so now Sariputta says he's going to break this experience down into the five aggregates. He says the material form in what has thus come to be is included in the material form aggregate subject to clinging. Okay, so when I see the bird or see anything, I see this chair, then there is something in that experience that belongs to the material form aggregate. And so what is that? In this experience, there's the I itself, that is the sense faculty with the ability to see, but which serves as the basis for the act of seeing. The door, the sense door for the act of seeing. Then there is the form of the object, the form of the chair. That is the external object, and that also belongs to the material form aggregate. So the aggregates are not only the body and mind, but it's the body and mind together with its corresponding world. So it's whatever form there is, internal or external, that is the form aggregate. Okay, at the time that experience occurs, there is some feeling. Every experience, according to this subtle way of analyzing the five aggregates, every experience is accompanied by some feeling. If I was walking for miles and miles and I see the chair, I'm tired, I want to rest, I see the chair, then there might be a feeling of pleasure, because I know that I can sit down. If I want to really sit back in a comfortable chair and somebody gives me one of these fold-out chairs, then maybe a feeling of displeasure. But if I'm just talking here and my eye falls on the chair, then it will be a neutral feeling. Okay, but there's some feeling that occurs, and that feeling belongs to the, that is, on that occasion, that is the aggregate of feeling. Then there is some perception. What is the perception? That is the mental function by which one is able to identify the object. That is what enables one to pick out the features of an object, and one knows what the object is. For example, if you see a person you know, one of your friends, what happens is this mental function of perception picks out of the visual field, maybe you're shown, let's say, to make it a little more interesting, you're shown a picture of a group of high school students. Maybe your friend shows you this group of high school students and says, which one is me? So maybe you didn't know that friend in high school. Maybe you know them only when they're 40 years old. So you have to look at the photograph, you look at each of the faces. And so what you're doing is sort of selecting features from the faces in order to see which corresponds most closely to the face of your friend who's now 40 years old. And then if you see certain features, that is perception, picking them out and assembling them together. And then at a certain point, it brings identification. Ah, that one is you. And he says, idiot, that's not me. Okay. So this is the work of perception, the perception aggregate. Then when one sees, on any occasion when one sees, there will be some way of responding to that object. It can be an approach through desire, wanting to get possession of something. It can be an approach governed by aversion, wanting to harm or to push away something. It can be any kind of action that one has to take in regard to that object. So all of these motivational factors, volitional factors, responsive factors, those make up the aggregate of the mental formations, or maybe better, volitional activities. And then, always in the background, there is the knowing of what is happening. And what I call the light of awareness that illuminates the field of cognition. And that is the aggregate of consciousness. So in that way, we have these five aggregates present in the experience of seeing a form. Okay, so now the meditator who's doing this kind of insight meditation reflects. He understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be the inclusion, gathering, and amassing of things into these five aggregates subject to clinging. In other words, through this object impinges on the eye is functional, attention turns to the object, consciousness arises, and along with consciousness there comes feeling, perception, volitional activities. So on that one occasion of seeing a form, all five aggregates arise together. They're present together. Okay, now, Sariputta says, this has been said by the Blessed One, by the Buddha. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. And one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. And then he applies this to the five aggregates and he reflects, these five aggregates are dependently arisen. So these five aggregates have arisen from a condition, from a cause. And so what is the origin of these five aggregates? He says the desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding or clinging based on these five aggregates, that is the origin of suffering. So now he's bringing in the noble truth of the origin or cause of suffering. Okay, we have the five aggregates. These five aggregates, common to being at conception through the, what's called here, the desire, indulgence, inclination, and grasping. So death has taken place, but there's still a holding to the five aggregates, and that holding brings into being the new set of five aggregates that make up our present experience. Okay, then the removal of desire and lust, the abandoning of desire and lust for these five aggregates, that is the cessation of suffering. So that is now the truth of cessation. When desire, clinging, craving are abandoned, then, of course, the five aggregates stand throughout life, but there's no coming into being any more of the five aggregates after passing away. So that becomes the cessation of dukkha. And then at this point, he says that at that point too, much has been done by that monk. Okay, then the same thing is applied in the rest to each of the other sense faculties. The one that's interesting is number 37. Here we have the mind is intact, okay, normally it is, but no external mind objects come into range. Normally mind objects, they're external in the sense that they're considered objects, but the mind objects themselves are internal in that they're purely mental events, not external events. Okay, but let's say, to take an example, my thought about my summer vacation in the year 1957. I don't know what I did then, but let's say that memory doesn't come into range of my mind. Then there's no corresponding type of consciousness, no memory of what I did on my summer vacation in 1957. Okay, if internally the mind is intact and externally mind objects come into range, but there is no engagement. This is interesting because it suggests that, in fact, when you practice mindfulness meditation, you see how this happens all the time, that the mind is moving very, very quickly and images, impressions, ideas are flowing into the mind or flickering into the mind. You know, it seems almost like dozens of times, hundreds of times a second. But very seldom, only on special occasions, do they actually engage our attention. And so these images and impressions will be floating quickly through the mind, or fleeting, flickering through the mind. Maybe this is almost like a Buddhist version of the working of the subconscious, which is supposedly discovered by Freud. Okay, so there's no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. But when internally the mind is intact and external mind objects come into its range, and there is the attention to them, then there is the manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. Okay, I think back 1957. Let's see, I was 12 years old. Yeah. Now I think that was my first summer in a place called Tustin Mountain Lake Summer Resort. Okay, so I remember. Okay, then the rest is developed in the same way. The material form, which has thus come into being, you know, we have this body, brain functioning, nerve functioning, and so on. That's all part of the material aggregate. Then there's a feeling, perception, volitional activities, consciousness. Each belongs to its own aggregate. Then, so that's the analysis by way of the five aggregates. These five aggregates have originated through desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding. These are all just names for craving. And then the removal of desire and lust and so on for these five aggregates, that is the cessation of suffering. And so we treat the noble truth of suffering, the origin, cessation, and then we could say that the whole practice being described here of investigating the experience in terms of the five aggregates, this is the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. So even though the path isn't specifically mentioned, but just by describing the practice, the noble truth of the path is included. So in this way, Sariputta has brought together the entire teaching of the Four Noble Truths using this very complex analytical scheme. Okay, at this point then I'll ask now whether you have any questions based on the whole sutta. Take the floating microphone.
The question about the order of form, feelings, perception, volition, consciousness, I see it listed in this order always, but does not take place in this order.
Yeah, this is an interesting point. Did you have something further you wanted to say?
Well, really wanting to question the particular order and why or if there's a relevance to it.
Okay. I think the reason why this particular order is used is in order to go from what is coarser or easier to understand to what is subtler, more difficult to see, more difficult to understand. And so form, especially form is the body, that's relatively easy to see. Then feeling is something which is, you know, much of the time we're attentive to our feelings. And so we could see, you know, especially pleasure and pain. A lot of our mental activity centers around avoiding pain and experiencing pleasure. Okay, then perception would be more subtle than feeling. The volitional activities, maybe they're held to be more subtle than perception. But at any rate, actually, they don't seem to me to be more subtle than perception, but the volitional activities usually become more prominent as a response to perception. It's when we identify things or when we feel things that we respond to them with some kind of activity. And then consciousness is the most subtle, because it's just, the way I see it, it's just that basic awareness sort of lurking in the background that lights up the field.
Right. In the example of the chair being tired, there is the eye sitting in the chair, so we have the form with the eye, the form of the chair.
Yeah.
The feeling of relief or being happy to see the chair only comes after the perception.
Yeah. Yeah,
perceiving that it is a chair, the conceptual, the concept of a chair.
Yeah.
So in that case, it's a different order. In your discussion regarding volition, which is a response to an event, that can happen before the actual perception. The response can be automatic, the response can be there. It could be, for example, a violent response that is there before perception.
Actually, that is true. I'd say normally first the perception takes place and then a response to it. But there are probably many examples in which a response could take place even before a clear perception takes place. Maybe can you give some example of that?
A response before perception?
Yeah.
For example, if the body is hurt, before knowing what the hurt is, comes from, there would be a response. But thank you, your explanation really works for that.
Yeah. But normally the way the suttas explain the way the aggregates come into being. Okay, we have, let's take the case of visual perception, visual cognition. Okay, the form impinges on the eye, then consciousness or mind gets turned towards the object through the eye, and consciousness, when it turns to the object, we say that contact takes place. Contact is the encounter between consciousness and the object through the sense faculty, in this case the eye. Then that encounter is called contact, and then from contact there arises perception, feeling, perception, and volition.
Right. I'm asking because sometimes in meditation it is more difficult to see the dependence arising when one looks at objects that way, and because this order is not always the same.
The order is not always the same, yeah. Yes, Trey.
Okay. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. And I know you got me asked to do this last week. It seems that the main thrust of what the Great One Sariputta is teaching here, these teachings are specifically they're designed to remove self from the five aggregates.
Yeah, but to remove the conception of self.
Conception of self. Because the sense of self is so deeply ingrained in the aggregates. I mean, that's just what this really strikes me. And in terms of the Eightfold Noble Path, it really seems to me, especially what is focused upon here, is the right view.
Yeah. That seems to be a thin Sariputta's special. Specialty.
It also occurs to me when he, especially when he says much is being left by this vicar, especially towards the end, that if you could really, really realize that, we would seem to be akin to stream entry, you know, because if you could really, just really get rid of that sense of self and see things as they are, then much would be done. I mean, it's not that hard to comprehend intellectually.
Yeah.
I get it. But to really do it, it's a whole other thing.
I think that's also one of the reasons why the sutta is so repetitive, in that it's the way the ancients would treat a sutta, not just like we do, like a text to read. You know, some in some of the classes I hear they assign the Majjhima Nikaya 2 weeks. 3 weeks. So what can you do? You just go through reading like a novel. That's not really the way you do it. But it's supposed to be something that you take up slowly and then you absorb the ideas and then use it for contemplation, going through it mentally again and again and again. And then first the thoughts at somewhat of an intellectual level, but then through that repetitive process of repeating, that intellectual activity turns into experiential insight. Okay, let's take some of the internet questions. Is contact part of perception and consciousness just the knowing? The contact itself is not treated as part of perception, but contact is treated as a condition for perception. So the way the suttas define contact, they say it's the coming together of three things: consciousness, object, and sense faculty. But the way I explain it it's the coming together of consciousness with the object through the sense faculty. And then when that encounter with the object takes place, then perception occurs. Okay, I have heard the statement that there are the five aggregates and five aggregates of clinging. Please explain this. I think to put it at maybe a simple level is that first, the five aggregates is a broader category than the five aggregates of clinging. And so there should be five aggregates that are without clinging, and those are probably the aggregates of an arhat. So for anybody who's not an arhat, there's still some clinging, and that makes them the five aggregates subject to clinging. But in the case of the arhat without clinging, then there'll be just the five aggregates. Third question, how do thoughts arise in the mind? That's a big question. It's a complicated issue. It doesn't really relate directly to the sutta. Oh, I see, these are other questions. Does the Pali Canon say anything about the relationship between the mind and the brain? No. In fact, I think the function of the brain, or the role of the brain as a basis for consciousness or mental activity, was just discovered in the 19th century. Maybe if anybody knows more about that, let me know. But I think before that, or maybe the 18th century, before that, the function of the brain was not understood. But I'll have to check on that. But nothing is said in the canon about the brain except in part of the one version of the contemplation of impurity, the impure parts of the body. Okay, could you explain the meaning of the statement in footnote 341, profounder implications 341? Oh yeah, this is that quote that comes in the sutta, that one who sees dependent origination sees the Dharma, one who sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. It's interesting, Sariputta says, thus it was said, or as it was said by the Blessed One, but I mean, the whole Pali Canon, and the only place in the Pali Canon where you find that statement is in this sutta, Sariputta quoting the Buddha. And so, I mean, it almost is a direct indication that either Sariputta's memory was defective, which I doubt, or that there were other statements of the Buddha which didn't get into the Pali Canon. Probably the latter is correct. Then I say, the commentary glosses this, perhaps with too little sensitivity to the statement's profounder implications. The commentary says, one who sees dependent origination sees dependently arisen states, states as plural dhammas, and one who sees dependently arisen states sees dependent origination. So the commentary here just takes the word dhamma to mean phenomena, things that are dependently originated. But what I meant by saying that there are profounder implications is that the statement is indicating that really the heart or essence of the Buddha's Dhamma or teaching is dependent origination. So that is in a way like the key to the unique discovery, special discovery of the Buddha, is that all Dhammas or phenomena originate from conditions and cease with the ceasing of their conditions. Okay, we'll have to stop now for the lunch break, and then we'll come back after lunch for a short discussion. Oh, I see. Now I see when they're running to get the handout sheets for the verses.
Is there any announcement about future dates?
Oh, wow, I haven't put out... Yeah, let's see, next week is July 2nd, 3rd, is it the 3rd? Yeah, there won't be a class next week because it's the Dhammas camp is going on here. We could have a class the week after that, July 10th, July 17th, and we'll take next, I will make up the list and then send it to Kaiti, but what we'll take next will be, I think it's the longer discourse on the simile of the heartwood.
The longer or shorter?
The shorter one.
Excuse me?
Sure, yeah, I know.
You said third, number 30 in here.
Yeah, it's number 30. Yeah. Then I'll make up a list of the ones that come after that, that the students will study after that. Okay, so let us share the merits.
Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyanta Nanumodipa Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyanta Nanumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyanta Nagamodipa Chiram Rakantu Mamparan Eta Vatacha Amhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadhaya Vichihetato Etantare Satakayupapanna Rupiya Rupicha Asanya Sanino Dukha Pamuchantu Posantu Nibutin.
Okay, we end with three bows, Buddha.
Thank you.